them.
Just because we play what the people want.
Yeah, quick.
So them a call us pirates. Them a call us illegal broadcasters. PTI try stop us, but they can't.
And welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined, as always,
by a very white guy.
And you are very white indeed.
Booyakasha!
Booyakasha, really? That's where we're going?
Booyakasha!
You are on 10, dude. Turn up.
We've got a day off. We're going to do a little road trip.
We are road tripping.
We're going to be seeing some friends. Yep. Baby Steven.
Steven!
Come on! That's a booyakasha!
Booyakasha.
Booyakasha!
So,
Beatrice is back to health, right?
The Beast.
The Beast!
Is back.
If y'all have a dog, consider, like, pet insurance. I think that is a thing, right? Like, one of our friends, didn't Kaylee get a vet bill swallowing something like a needle and she had to like thousands of dollars?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pet insurance, I'm going to say that's, I might consider that.
I feel like
forward.
It doesn't cover half of that stuff though.
Yeah, I don't know. This was crazy. So she
she had two abscessed teeth that had to be removed. They had to put her under and it was pretty painful for her, poor thing, but she's finally
on the mend.
Back to herself again and acting silly and we love her.
It's because she's a chewer. She broke her teeth, both of them, because she chews rocks, sticks, stuff.
She's a chomper.
She's a chomper. She's back.
Well, if this is your first time joining us, you can find us, Interracial John, on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Or you can go to our website, Interracial John. That's JAWN. And, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr. Just search at Interracial John, again, JAWN. And we really like to get some reviews. I see some of you people out there listening to us.
Mm.
Where the fuck are the reviews?
For real.
Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
So you can leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. If it's 5 stars, we will read it on air. Shout out to Black Guy Who Tips. And
I'm side-eyeing right now.
Just get on it, Johners.
And you know, John, if you're not aware, it's a Philly word. I connected with a tweet whose Twitter handle is Jean Valjean.
Oh, nice.
I was like, you got to be from Philly.
Jean Valjean.
Jean Valjean.
I love it.
Straight up. That's Philly to the
one.
Core.
That's great. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get the show on the road, man.
The news is coming on. The news is coming on.
The news is coming on. So did you hear that we've talked about like whitewashing history and various problematic things that are happening in regards to, I don't know, just speaking the truth?
Yeah.
So now there's a Kansas bill that would send teachers to jail for 6 months. Jail teachers for teaching harmful materials.
Mm-hmm.
A lawmaker in Kansas is seeking to criminalize the distribution of harmful materials to minors in schools, lifting an exemption for teachers using approved materials. That's the school board approved.
Mm-hmm.
Advocates working against the bill worry it will have a chilling effect on the teachers in the state. It's a reaction to the instance of a particular sex ed poster. So a teacher had made a sex ed poster and it said, how do people express their sexual feelings? And it had a variety of, you know, hugging, sexual fantasy, touching. And it included anal sex and oral sex on the poster.
Well, this was middle school?
I'll say it's perhaps a little bit too frank. For middle school in that
it
regard.
It was middle school?
Let's see here. Text poster. Yes, it was a middle school.
Okay, got it.
So this is a reaction to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's now going to put you in jail for 6 months for teaching unapproved materials. And in Arizona, on the not approved list is a class that included a poem. And it was basically for Latino and Latina individuals. And it was deemed too anti-white. So they've banned it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of scary. I don't want to call it like thought police, but god damn.
Yeah, it's definitely on that road for sure. That happened at the Howard Middle School that's on Howard University's campus, the charter school that's there, where teachers were teaching Black history that was outside of the curriculum. And not only did the principal there fire the teachers, but they had the teachers escorted by police in front of their students in the
Jesus.
Middle of the class day.
And this is probably in the last, like, what? How many years? This year? Last year? A couple years ago?
It was like a month ago.
A month ago. What the fuck?
And the students, middle school students, staged a walkout the next day in protest.
You know, here in Philadelphia, and I don't know the exact circumstances, but Anthony Montero from Temple got drummed out of office, his post and position. You know, and when you start – you know, we already deliberately obfuscate actual history so much, right? It's written by the winners.
Sure.
And the dominant narrative and the dominant culture is writing the history. And it just, you know, when we talk, and we've talked on the show, it's not manifest destiny and how the West was won. It was systemic genocide of indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just, it's so pervasive and just complete. And now we're literally going to be jailing people. You know, there's an option on the table and people are behind this. Like it's an okay thing. Like this is normal to jail a teacher, an educator for teaching
the teaching
that's not quote unquote approved.
Yeah. These school bars are crazy, but all right. You know,
fucking nuts, man.
You know, these elections do matter, people. These small decisions.
Know, and Frank from CCOP was here yesterday talking to me.
Yeah.
And that's their big push coming up is the primary elections coming up. And there's, here in New Jersey, a bunch of seats coming up as well.
Right.
And he said that in Camden County, there was an unopposed individual, had no opponent at all. Of course, they won. And there's another individual that won with a grand total of like 180 votes. You know, so it's really, I don't want to say it's not, you know, it should be easy to impact things on the local level. And I don't know if there's enough people that care about running for office on the local level. And I don't know what the solution is, but my gosh, we got to, as a group, start doing something.
Yeah, for sure. It's got to, yeah.
And it's those local level, the primaries that, I don't want to say that they matter, but by the time you get to the general election, it's too fucking late.
Yeah, it's true.
They've picked a person.
Late. They've put the idiots already in the midst.
Yeah. And I doubt GOP Republicans listen to the show, but we can be different ideologically, but just go vote in the primaries and don't let these fucking wackadoos be your candidates.
Representatives.
Yeah. No Michelle Bachmanns, please.
Please. We're begging you. So, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about this story about I was just dubbing it memes gone wrong because, you know, things take off as memes and you don't really sometimes think about, you know, the object of them and kind of how they come to be and what the aftermath is of them. We talked a little bit about this about it was not a meme, but about that chick that sent the AIDS Africa tweet, whatever the fuck her name
right.
was. This is something different. You may or may not have seen it, but there's a picture.
I did. And you know, this not too much, but it reminds me of the – wasn't there a meme about babies that looked like old people?
Yes.
And it kind of reminds me of that. It's like
– It is.
It's not necessarily in good taste. It's a baby.
It's a baby. So anyway, so there's a little girl who has a disease, actually. She's 2 years old. Her name is Mariah. She suffers from chromosome 2 duplication syndrome, which causes impairments to her motor functions and development. And last week, as part of her birthday celebration, her mom posted her picture on Facebook. And all of a sudden, all of these memes started popping up. Just referring to how she looked. She has kind of like, there's just physical attributes to the condition that she has.
Correct.
And it went so quickly, just started going everywhere. I actually didn't see it. I saw it in this article, but they have an example of one, and it's just kind of like in really bad taste. And of course, Mariah's too. She doesn't know she was being laughed at, but, you know, it's just the idea of, two things came to my mind. One is, you know, the danger of posting your child's or any photo on any social media, which is something I've heard a lot of parents say they don't want to post any pictures of their child because who knows what they want to do with that in the future. I did see somebody have a suggestion or something people suggest when you have a baby is to open a Gmail account in a Google account with a Gmail email address in their name and send pictures and stuff to that email address. And then when they turn whatever, give them access to the email address and all of that.
Giving them control.
And that it hasn't been shared anywhere, but they can decide.
Sure.
But they have kind of this archive of things
at the same
time. So anyways, I thought that was a really kind of compromise because then you as a parent feel like you are kind of archiving. But you give your child the option to do with it.
I don't remember who it was, and it was not anybody we knew, but a couple of years ago there was a story that went around of a woman that had used Picasso as like a, you know, the photo sharing app.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And hadn't really made any, you know, paid any attention to it. But one day was looking at, I guess there's like statistics as to like how many people have viewed or downloaded this picture, that picture.
Right.
And saw she had an album that had like, you know, 10, 12 views. And one of the pictures had like 14,000, just like, you know, skyrocketed, like in a anomaly.
Right.
And it included a, you know, it was like a baby picture of a two-year-old that was naked in a tub, like something innocent that a parent would maybe have. And it was clearly that it went around some really inappropriate circles and people were sharing it. And she was just devastated, you know, like, oh my God. Like you said, you got to be really careful what you put online.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I just wanted to mention that. I thought it was interesting. You brought up, I thought a couple of things. One is how, you know, we don't always think about the other side of memes we may or may not laugh at, especially when there's children involved or really anybody, because you never know what's going on with the person. And then two, just this idea of what you share and how it gets shared and what could happen from there.
Yeah.
Moving on. Of course, we'd be remiss in talking about news and not mentioning the Department of Justice findings in Ferguson, both deciding that there were no reason to file civil rights infringement charges against Darren Wilson in the death of Michael Brown, and also at the same time their dual investigation, which was on the Ferguson Police Department and municipal court system, which was in Eric Holder's words, blistering account.
Scathing
and blistering account of the, you know, egregious ways in which they take advantage of the poor and black population in the city there. And I want to point out two things. One is that this is nothing. This is not an anomaly.
No,
There's nothing special about Ferguson or its police department. Two, it's a full display of the ways in which white supremacy influences every aspect of our society.
Sure.
And then three, I think a lot of I've had a lot of white people in particular ask me, you know, how can they find all of these horrible racist things going on in the system, but then say that Darren Wilson wasn't
at fault? I'd say the same thing.
You said the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, not how can they not? I mean, that's the intent and the purpose of the system and everything set up to protect him. But I tweeted
I don't think it's set up to protect him. What it's set up to do is give due process to Darren Wilson and actually look at the evidence. Also, in a federal investigation, the bar is incredibly high in terms of proving a civil rights violation has occurred.
True.
I mean, really, really high.
It should be.
He had to be like yelling nigger at him while wearing a KKK outfit and then shooting him in the back of the head with, you know, everybody watching almost. I mean, that's literally the level that you have to be in.
Well, maybe
the bar goes. I'm not kidding. You can look at the statue if you want.
I said it should be high. I don't know if it should be that high.
I'm just saying it is that high. I'm not advocating that it should be, but I'm saying that it is that high. So I'm not surprised that they were not able to bring charges against him. I will say, though, the flip side of this is that, as you mentioned, that the system is not set up to protect him, but it is set up to... It has been, and it is set up for him to do his job exactly the way that he did it.
Yeah.
And that really is the bigger issue, I think. And that's not one that something that the Department of Justice is going to be able to address, because they are part of the system that perpetuates the idea that his life.
Sure.
And the idea that he was threatened, whether he was or wasn't, that the end result of that is okay for somebody to be killed. So.
No, I forget if it was Malcolm or MLK. Someone at some point had quoted about, you know, the dominant system. It's never going to point out its own faults. It's just not going to do it. That's against its nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would signal its demise to everyone involved. It's just not going to do that. And Darren Wilson's a part of that. Mike Brown's not.
Correct.
And even the police department in the report and I guess we're starting to see some of the aftermath. It just to me rings so. You know, the mantra Black Lives Matter, when people are getting fired or suspended for having racist emails, but killing black people is okay,
mm-hmm.
You know? And that's, again, just this whole focus on an individual, one act. Like, our definition of racism is, you know, epithet-laden emails. Like, you know, let's expand that definition a little bit and include the system with which it's operating.
Well, you know, I take a couple of things. One is I'm pleased with the fact that the Department of Justice did a very thorough job in their investigation. It's very clear that they they really did go through everything that they possibly could between anecdotal evidence, speaking with both victims and the police department and city officials. There was a big emphasis on paper trails and exactly what did happen.
They didn't Olay it. It wasn't a fucking...
Yes. Secondarily, though, if you recall, the George Zimmerman decision just was released about 2 weeks ago.
So much quicker.
So it tells me that none of these other investigations should be as long as that one. There's no reason for it. Clearly, the job can be done in a very swift hand. Yeah. Not that this was swift, but certainly swifter than the George Zimmerman one. So that's the second thing I noted. And then the third thing I noted is that there wouldn't be a fucking Department of Justice investigation or report without all the protests that went on in Ferguson and the sure. people of Ferguson demanding that somebody pay attention to what was going on in their city. Somebody from the St. Louis Today tweeted yesterday something to the effect of that the Department of Justice review or their findings were that it was no surprise that the protesters, the people of Ferguson, would have automatically jumped to the conclusion that Darren Wilson's actions were racially motivated. Okay. And I replied, I said, no, you got it wrong. It's not a surprise. It's the logical thing yeah. to think based on the way that their department does business. And
especially the residents that live
yes,
there under
the writer
thumb
wrote
of that.
Back yeah. to me and said, that was much better said the way I said it. Because it's true. It's a very, like, to me, it's like, yeah, knowing all of these things that came out in the report, that's the reality that you're living in. Of course you would think that. Not only would you think that, I would bet every other case of somebody getting killed probably was racially motivated. And I still think that Darren Wilson's was, because he had all of these biases that are present in yeah. our system instilled in him. And not him as an individual, but him as a just American, you know, and an American police officer. So
you said that the DOJ report, you know, certainly in some capacity, the genesis of it is due to the protesters in Ferguson, people
yes.
standing up and saying, enough is fucking enough. This is ridiculous. And they got to that point because of the circumstances with which they were living under and had been saying they had been living under, but nobody really gave a shit and did anything about it. And now the DOJ report comes out and it's like, oh, you know, you guys were right. Like, you know, so it goes back to a little bit of like, you know, let's just believe people of color when they start saying, you know, this is what's going on.
This stuff is going on. Yeah.
yeah. And
how
then,
about that?
And not just that, but there's a little bit of the, like, you know, the lie gets told around the world 10 million times, and the information, the DOJ report, comes out many months later. And I think that it's getting amplified a lot more because the protesters didn't stop. They've been going nonstop since August 9th in Ferguson. So that, you know what I'm saying? Like, if it had been a longer, like, I think it's part of the reason the Zimmerman report was so slow, because they wanted to, like, just wait 3 years. People
right.
forget about
people
that
people forget
shit.
About
it'll
it.
It'll blow over.
They won't
you know?
Care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when you tell a lie, right? Like, even just now, like, I'm thinking of friends that we have that had conversations of the wait for justice, wait for the facts.
Right.
And it's like, you know, okay. And then when the non-indictment came out, some of them leveraged that as, see, facts came out. He had a, you know, it was a court. It was perfectly this. And then you had to wait another couple months, like, like what we've been saying, you know, what you quote unquote, air quote, put around the word facts wasn't really facts at all. It's a pile of shit. And the DOJ is telling us that.
Yeah.
But this is coming out how many more months later? The non-indictment mm-hmm. was November.
Well, let's give a few statistics here. In August of 2014, 43 black people were killed by police, including Mike Brown. That's the most ever recorded. Protests ignited. The month after Mike Brown was killed, the number of black people killed by police dropped 56% nationwide. I want to say that again. 56% nationwide as the protests were going on. 1 month after protests began, there were 60 fewer police killings. The number of black people killed by police dropped the most of all the killings. 24 fewer black people were killed by police the month after they started protesting.
Wow.
Think about that. So protests matter, and I wanted those numbers on the record
because
it's important.
You and I, I'm curious, what in that statistic does the author, anyone, ascribe some hypothesis as to the – is it because the police were more aware and vigilant and they were being more careful? What would you ascribe the drop in?
Oh, yeah, I would definitely ascribe the fact that people – the idea that at least black people cared that black lives did matter to
them.
The
spotlight was on a little bit.
Absolutely. Not just the spotlight, but just the fact that of you having to think about that fact. Just that vernacular being in the air.
Yeah, you're right about that.
That black lives matter. Maybe it will make you think twice about taking that.
Moves the needle some part.
Somebody might care.
Yeah.
I've been hearing this black lives matter thing. And there's a black guy in front of me. Somebody might care. I don't, but somebody might. Anyways, you can find those statistics on mappingpoliceviolence.org. It's a new, amazing collaboration.
Super awesome
of,
site.
Of technological advances and crowdsourcing of data from two of the Ferguson protesters, DeRay, who quit his job and moved to St. Louis this week. So congratulations on that, DeRay. I know he's in Selma right now, but really excited to see what he's going to be doing moving forward, and Annetta as well. And then the other person is at Sam Sway. Samuel. Yeah.
I think the combination of killedbypolice.net and mapping, was it Mapping Police Violence?
Yes.
Those two, powerful.
Yeah.
Because there's just no, you can't, there's no equivocation on it now. You can't fudge the number, right? And then, and what, I don't say pisses me off, but there was legally mandated requirement for police departments to submit this information to the federal government for years. And like barely anybody did it. Like 4% of police forces did it. And the law had a time limit and they let it expire. And it was like, okay, fuck it. We're not going to collect this data at all, from somewhere in the 90s to the middle of, like, I think the 2000s. And then they, okay, we'll reinstate the law again. And now barely, I don't know what percent, but it's not 100% compliant.
Absolutely.
So the protest movement has had to synthesize that data because our government refuses to enforce a law requiring it to be collected and analyzed.
Correct. Well, I'm not going to go through all the, we didn't want to go through all the details of the report. Lots of people will be talking about it. And I actually probably think that Ricky and I will end up doing a whole entire episode of Ferguson Response on the report. But I just wanted, we'll be putting a couple of links, not just to the report, but also to a couple of really great responses to it, both in statement form and in analysis. And we'll put those together. But I do want to read just one quick thing from Tori Russell, who's the co-founder of Hands Up United. Ferguson is a microcosm of how marginalized communities interact with the state, but also a spark that inevitably stokes the flames of justice in the hearts and minds of people of all creeds peppered throughout this country. What the DOJ has memorialized on paper, we will memorialize in action. So I'll include that link as well. He said more than that, but that was just the end of his comments. But
the other one's Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yes, Ta-Nehisi Coates will be up there. There's quite a few. Wes Lowry, and there's a fourth one. So we'll put all of those up there.
All very good. And the DOJ report's lengthy, and many other people have broken it down.
Yeah.
But the links that Leslie's talking about, really good material for understanding its impact.
Yes.
In a broader context, too.
Correct, Mundo. So, yeah.
You want to talk about the new slave museum?
Well, I don't want to, but we can. No, I do. Actually, it's very interesting, I think, anyways.
Hey, it's the first of its kind.
It is the first of its kind. So this is a new museum. It depicts the life of a slave from cradle to tomb. It's in Louisiana along the Serpentine River Road between Louisiana and Baton Rouge. It's known as Plantation Alley. So they've got a bunch of restored antebellum mansions that have people go there all the time, all year round. And so Whitney Plantation in Wallace, Louisiana, looks like any of the other plantations with a big French Creole style big house. But before you can see the late 18th century home furnished with period finery, a tour guide introduces you to the slaves who built it and everything else on this former sugarcane plantation, with the names of the 356 people enslaved on the plantation are etched in granite slabs on the wall of honor. It's overwhelming to see such names, says Avis Alexander Jesse of nearby Vatry. She wonders if a name etched here, Alexandra, born 1851, could be a relation. Our ancestor's name could be on this. So it's kind of interesting. Ibrahim Asek, who's the academic director at the plantation, she wanted to be able to show what the life of a slave from cradle to the tomb. You come here, you'll learn all about it. So a history professional from Senegal, Asek has written a book, Boukife Cambon, about the plantation founded by a German immigrant, Ambrose Hadel, in the 1700s. And it says that Hadel first brought his slaves into Louisiana at the Louisiana slave market in New Orleans, and the family had one of the largest slave forces in Louisiana. So He used the household inventory to piece together biographical data of the slaves, and they were recorded in the same way the plantation kept track of, you know, farm implements and physical assets.
As always.
Mm-hmm. And Vu Gabriel, a domestic in the big house, was born around 1790. He was from the Congo, from Central Africa. In the inventories, they called him Vu Gabriel, which means old Gabriel, because he lived on the plantation for about 50 years under four different masters. So it's pretty, you know, I would say it's 1,700 acre property.
Yeah.
That was bought from a petrochemical firm. And a trial lawyer spent millions on artifacts, research, and restoration. And they're hoping to get ribbon cutting done soon. John Cummings is a New Orleans trial lawyer who's been working since the 1990s to get this done. And I think it's going to be an interesting place for people to relive a true account of the history of slavery in Louisiana. Yeah.
My timeline had a discussion about it being a, you know, a well-to-do white guy.
Sure.
To some degree, like, is it centering on whiteness? Is it still framed in whiteness? Is it, you know, a white person using his privilege appropriately? And I think that because they had a historian and, you know, he's just the money behind it to some degree, I don't have any issue with it being a white guy. You know, it is what it is.
It is what it is. I also think that there is, you know, we're not from a slave plantation state. So I think that there's a very, you know, complex psychological connection to it that white people that live in those states feel, especially if they've been there for generations, because the knowledge really is very strong. They know that their ancestors were a part of this enterprise directly. And I can imagine, especially as a trial lawyer, that being something hard to reconcile.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, Ricky always talks about, you know, the fact that white guilt is real. And I'm not saying that was his reason
motivation
for doing this,
sure.
But I will say that, you know, it is something
that
white people have to come to terms with. And I can imagine this being one way of him coming to terms with that duality,
sure,
of believing in his country and being proud of his family, but acknowledging, you know, this horrific role that our country has had and his family probably had as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah. So there was I guess it was a tour they had, I don't know if it's open or opening day or, you know, some preview. And it was more than half people of color,
sure,
in attendance. And there was a definite sense of reverence, the one article I read. But so you talked about this, you know, I don't want to say identification, but as a plantation state, there's a, you know, there's a weird kind of love-hate relationship with them to some degree for some people. And on the other side of the spectrum,
yeah,
is Frogmore Plantation.
Frogmore.
This is their website. Yeah. I'm just going to let this load.
Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. I jump down, turn around,
seriously,
pick a bale of day. I jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton.
The fuck?
I jump down, turn around,
that's the goddamn
day.
Website.
Oh, Lord,
I'm going to stop because...
Oh, Lord,
I can't.
Like, why is it still playing?
I can't figure out how to fucking mute the goddamn
Good
thing.
Good Lord.
It's a historical, educational, agricultural, and industrial working plantation selected by Rand McNally as a must-see site.
Hmm.
Frogmore Cotton Plantation and Gin. They've got slave quarters. They do I got to fucking turn that shit off. What the hell?
Oh, my.
Lord, why was that playing again? So they literally have like a slave wedding at one point. They reenact a slave wedding.
Wow.
It's just absolutely egregiously disgusting. And I heard about it through Kristen West Savali. She goes by K. West Savali on Twitter. Her great-grandmother was born on Frogmore Plantation. Now white kids and their parents go and pick cotton for fun and see slave wedding reenactments. And along those same disturbing lines, there's a trend now. Getting married at a plantation. It's now a popular wedding destination, literally. Plantation weddings aren't anything
new.
Well,
wasn't that the whole thing with Paula Deen?
Yeah, she did get in trouble because of among the many racially insensitive and inappropriate things she did say that she wanted to throw for her brother, I think it was, a plantation wedding replete with all black servers and yada, yada, yada. But, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I do remember there was this big thing that happened a couple of years ago with Ani DiFranco, you know, the, like, you know, riot girl feminist,
yeah,
singer, you know. She was doing this big retreat, you know, for women, righteous retreat, I think it was called. And she was having it at one of these plantations. And not only was she having it at the plantation, but it was like this big whole thing where people were like, that's the worst place that you could possibly have this thing because, you know, people were enslaved there and you're trying to be there talking about bringing together, you know, wholeness, and you're paying these people money. It was pretty shitty. And she had, and people were paying like $1,000 to go to this thing. And she, being a white woman, had no fucking clue why anybody would be concerned about this. First started with a non-apology, and then finally was like, okay, just forget it. So I do remember that, actually. I think it was like in 2013. I think you can play that right there.
Pause it. I can't find it. Oh, here you go.
White people.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah.
White people.
I mean, that deserves two. Good Lord.
Well, speaking of white people, let's go to some white person that's a little more fun then.
What are you playing now?
Well, there come across my timeline today a video of one young Brody Kritz and his bar mitzvah invitation video. So let's see what soon-to-be 13-year-old Brody has to say.
Oh, boy.
Here we go.
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say. The countdown's begun to my mitzvah day.
Uh-oh.
He's got outfits and shit.
His older brother is not happy.
My head's up in space. Hands in the air, like I don't care, just want to party.
He wants to party, you guys.
Because I'm Jewish. Clap along if you feel like Old Testament is the truth. Because I'm Jewish. Clap along if you're 13, that means you're no longer a youth.
Oh, yeah.
He's got on, like, the hat with the payas. Oh, my Lord. Like
clap along if you're my maid, you wear a really expensive suit.
If you're my maid?
No, mate.
Oh, mate.
All of me would love all of you to come attend my mitzvah. Mom would probably cry and get all snotty. You're gonna lift all of me.
There's real production value in this, man. Like, multiple camera angles.
Check out the service at the beginning. I'll be the guy on the beam of tweeting hashtag I'm winning. You understand every word I read, even if you are not a Jew. Whoa.
Oh my
God. I'm gonna make my brother wear a dress.
His brother is pissed in this video.
I put my sister in a cage, just like my doggy.
What's with the wig?
My parents all kind of stressed.
The permits for Bill.
They'll all do what I say, cause this here's my party, and I'm allowed to be spoiled. Shouting orders like a king. You cannot make a fuss. Even if you think it sucks, let me be your ruler. Call me King Brody, and baby I'll rule, I'll rule, I'll rule, I'll rule. That's my mitzvah fantasy. Let it go, let it go.
Oh my God. There's like CGI and shit, dude.
This is high quality.
I said it's got production value.
Mixed for jokes here. I just always wanted to try that.
Everybody get up.
Uh-oh.
Bring your sleeping bag.
He's naked.
Don't even hesitate. We're going all night. That's how we celebrate. Maybe we'll all go deaf. Maybe we'll all go blind.
Brody
maybe
really went there.
I'm seeing nerd lines. My rabbi,
I'm right
on standby.
Hello,
friends. Standby. RSVP to my party. It's all about me.
Holla.
Get up.
Holy fuck.
Oh my God.
Brody.
Brody.
Shut the door.
Brody. God bless you, Brody. I hope everybody comes to your bar mitzvah. I hope it's the most rocking ass party ever. First of all, I love bar mitzvahs. The year I turned 13, I went to 8 bar mitzvahs, and they were all fantastic. I love them. I'm from Brooklyn.
Kid just won the fucking internet. That was hilarious.
That was great.
And confident young man.
Very confident.
I had a body like his for many years in school. I would never have been naked.
He is ready to become a man. Let's just tell him.
He's all about it, man.
Go for it, Brody. Good on you.
Put his brother in a dress, man.
His brother was so shitty in every scene. He was like, this motherfucker right here.
That was honest to God fucking hilarious. And I hate to bring the mood down, but... Yes, all cops.
I think a month or so ago, we had highlighted Pittsburgh police yep. chief for, having that sign he held up and, you know, trying to bring some racial justice into his workplace, which would be the Pittsburgh Police Department. He got some backlash for that.
I followed him, and we had a couple Twitter interactions. I thanked him for it. His sign was about ending white silence. His New Year resolution was to end white silence and address bias and racism in the department. Like, literally, he came out, you know, pretty – spoke truthfully. And he got a lot of backlash, I believe.
Yes, he did. He did. So, since 2012, community activists and political leaders have been calling for Officer David Derbysh, the man who shot Ford. We talked about this and the other things. We put on death duty. He shot an individual who's now paralyzed.
Right.
His calls intensified once the Department of Justice began investigating the shooting. But McLay, who is our hailed hero, wouldn't initially remove Derbysh from the streets. And when he finally did, it had nothing to do with community concerns. Instead, he wrote an open letter to the community, read black people, on Christmas Eve, saying that the assassination of 2 officers in New York now has me extremely concerned about the potential for similar violence and for the safety of our officers.
So he pulled Derbysh off. He made it a general claim about officers and then protected the one that killed or paralyzed a young man.
At this point, however, for the integrity of the police bureau, I need to make this formal until the U.S. Department of Justice investigation is complete. Our officer has been assigned to death duty. He is not being so assigned for punitive reasons, meaning it's okay to let the abusive police officers who are costing taxpayers thousands of dollars to roam the streets, but a crime against that police officer and a police officer in a whole different state means that the cops need more protection, not citizens.
Yeah.
I'm not done.
And just, it wasn't even like to claim the shit in New York. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
All of these actions took place before McLay took the picture that made him a folk hero. And since the hashtag ending white silence twit pic went viral, well, the chief apologized to the police union, argued in favor of stop and frisk policing, and quietly shut down his Twitter account after too many questions about contradictions between his photo and his policies. In this era of raw nerves, protests, and increased tensions, Americans really want leadership. It's natural for the public and the media to desperately seek out examples that appear to affirm that our nation is changing for the better. But if our desire for quick answers, accessible leaders, and hashtag activism takes the place of real investigation and substantive changes, the nation has done a disservice. Can he be called an example of good policing when he backs down to a bullying union and supports long debunked policing strategies that disproportionately harm people of color? Or does a viral picture taken with a bunch of activists in a copy shop outweigh the actual actions and policies on the ground? It's important as this national dialogue continues that we remember it is policies and commitment that matter, not just photo ops and hashtags.
Actions.
While a picture may be worth 1,000 words, it can give us a distorted image, and the picture isn't worth much at all.
Yeah, it's we've talked a bunch of different times about outcome versus intent.
Sure.
And, you know, I just, fucker, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember his interaction on Twitter was a little bit, because it went viral, right? It's a cop. He's in uniform holding this thing. It's like, wow, fucking fantastic, finally. Like, I think we even, at one point on our show, it said, we need an individual, right? There was I think it was the president of a certain union. I think it was the AFL-CIO spoke very powerfully and truthfully about supremacy and anti-blackness. I was like, man, that's amazing. And, you know, you think this is a guy that's doing that. But now it's just him holding a sign that, you know, he was in a place with activists that wrote on it, and it got a bunch of thousands of retweets, and he turns out to be just a fucking asshole and kind of a bigot and perpetuating supremacy.
Yeah, so there's that. Yeah, so back to, yes, all cops. Because we had done the record scratch for him, and now we have to take it back.
Yeah, please.
Fucker.
Thanks for that.
You bastard.
All right.
So, I think you said this to me, the whipping boy?
Yeah.
Did you read the story or no?
I didn't. I just saw the title, and I was like, oh, Drew might like this.
Yeah, so Alan Kurzweil was haunted for decades until he found out the guts to face the past in his book, The Whipping Boy. And he seeks out, investigative style, a bully that bullied him from 40-odd years ago. And the article's, it's good, but it talks about there being some duality Kurzweil having in writing the book. There's certainly some parts that were fun and enjoyable, but other parts that were kind of dark and hard to address. But then the main character, his bully, Caesar, they allude to a very peculiar path and a strange adult life, maybe even a strange work or something. But they obviously don't give it away because they want you to buy and read the book.
Right.
But he talks about it being, I don't know, like, you know, at one part, equal parts hard and difficult, but also maybe cathartic. And I haven't talked on the podcast, but I know you and I have talked about that, you know, I would say I had a bully, but there was a couple different incidents when I was growing up. An individual had made a comment that really, you know, you think a comment shouldn't affect you that much, but it was a pretty hurtful and deliberate and powerful negative comment. And it did. It affected me. It really kind of it tainted a trip and an experience that I was going to have. And, I've, you know, this is going on 30-some-odd years. And I'd like to say, oh, I'm totally over it. But I'd say maybe 10 years ago, when Facebook was just kind of getting big.
Right.
I was like, oh, you know, and all of a sudden you're starting to connect with people from here and there. And you're talking about like photos and privacy and this and that. In the beginning days of Facebook, everything was public. You really didn't like know what you were doing to some degree. And I, through other people, stumbled on this individual that said this thing to me, his Facebook page. And, you know, I don't want to like say who it is and, you know, put him on the blast or nothing, but literally was like, you know, like quote unquote, like a ski bum. Right, like that was sort of like his living, and there was a photo of him at like some like a resort or something, and his quote on the thing was something to the equivalent of like, yeah, do you see the problem? Me too, all fat chicks. Like, yeah. And I was like, oh my god,
he's still an asshole.
Wow, I was an like, asshole. I don't know why, but like a little bit like, it's not me. He's still a complete fucking dick.
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah, I can relate.
Yes, can relate. You can relate. You found your bully, and he's still a douche. So I saw this article, which I just had to bring to the fore, which is it's titled "No Love for Looking for Girlfriend Guy: Just Sex with 118 Women." New Yorkers of frequent Lower Manhattan have undoubtedly seen Dan Perino's face plastered on one of his thousands of, quote, looking for a girlfriend flyers. Since he started posting the ads for companionship last summer, he's been flooded with phone calls, more than 8,000, he says. He also claims to have hooked up with 118 women. So he tweets, "You guys probably think that my place is some kind of orgy. On second thought, you're probably right. Time to make her breakfast in bed. It's been going great," he says. He's 50. He's 50. "I've had hookups with 118 girls, but the dating is a lot more than that."
You know, that's a 100. He's had sex with 118 out of 8,000. That's like 1.5%.
Yeah.
That's kind of the same ROI you'd get from a mail campaign. You said like an email, you get like 17% people to open it and like 1.5 people to click.
Yeah, definitely playing the numbers. That's crazy. To give you some more numbers, he's also found time between hookups to film a documentary, write a short story, and is hoping to fund a reality show from his exploits. And the calls keep coming, the phone keeps ringing. He says he was getting 200 to 300 calls per day. "I couldn't get back to everybody. It was difficult. I got back to everybody by now. There's been over 8,000 phone calls. I posted well over 40,000 flyers.
Whoa.
I try to keep it below 14th Street, although I do go up to Midtown sometimes. Whether he intended or not, he's a minor New York celebrity now. Women, quote, get nervous around him on dates and be..."
Is he good looking?
He's all right. But even after all the dates and all the sex, still no girlfriend. Perino insists he's not, quote, picky when it comes to choosing a partner. But if he had to say a nice human woman that is aged 25 to 37 and is marriage material and wants a family. Also, this woman should be available every day or every other day to go walking or on unplanned events. Another problem is that he just can't seem to say the right things on dates. There's an interview process, Perino says. Even if you go on a coffee date, there's an interview process the woman does. They kind of ask you questions without you knowing to see if you're going to be strong enough and attractive enough to be with them. There's no such thing as men picking up women. It just doesn't exist.
Oh, really? 118 hookups later doesn't exist, Daniel?
His last
and 40,000 flyers, like even at like a modest price per printout, that's like $1,500. And then all his time and fucking labor and fucking staples, like, you know, he's now into like a couple thousand dollars. In time, shit, he's probably into like $4,000 or $5,000.
He looks kind of like Huck from Scandal. Anyways, he says, I'm a valuable man. I have everything I need except the woman of my dreams. So.
And he keeps it below 14th Street.
Yep. You know, he's got to keep it fresh, man.
Help me out. What's above 14th Street?
14th Street is like Chelsea, so above that's Midtown. So
more like the financial district, more expensive?
No, financial district, I keep telling you this, is way downtown.
So what's Midtown?
Midtown's like 34th Street.
Oh. All right.
Okay.
I don't know why you'd cut Midtown out. Too
high. That's probably putting where he lives. He wants it close to where he wants to be.
Oh, I see.
Because it's like, there's like a whole thing in New York where you're like, oh, I don't want to go to the west side. I want to go east side. I want to go uptown. I stay downtown. So it's like a big thing. Do I need to go all the way to Brooklyn? Do I have to go all the way into the city?
This guy's going to write a book and get a sitcom out of fucking making
We'll
40,000 flyers.
All right. So the other funny thing I thought that happened was Nick Young, Swaggy P.
Swaggy P.
Basketball player for the Lakers. And as you know, he dates one Australian rap-ish person, Iggy Azalea. So apparently a while ago, I didn't even know this. I'm going to play this right now. Nick Young claims a dolphin tried to kill him. So let's listen to his recount of the dolphin.
Those fucking situation. Dolphins are deadly.
It reminded me of King of the Hill. So here we go. Why are you scared
of dolphins? Oh, man, this is a long story, you know, vacation. Dolphin was trying to kill me for some reason, you know. Like, he was playing with everybody else. You know, doing what dolphins do, the ant and all that. It was my turn to ride the dolphin. For some reason, he took me all the way to the bottom, you know. So, yeah, he's trying to drown me. But I seen it happening, so I jumped out the water and took off the little life vests and just threw my little water shoes and stayed outside.
You were doing this on purpose and you jumped in there with him?
No, it was my turn. You know, everybody went around in circles, hang on a little fin, you know. And when I went on, he didn't go around. He just went straight down. So he was trying to kill me. So,
yeah. Why didn't a dolphin like you, man? What's he got against Nick Young?
He's a racist.
I don't know. I think he was trying to, you know, get at Iggy because he was a little friendly, kissing her and stuff. So it was, yeah, he was trying to take my woman, probably.
Okay, so
he's jealous of the racist dolphin.
Yes. So the dolphin, he's afraid of dolphins. So he, this is what he is.
He did the ee thing.
He did the ee thing. And he was saying,
okay. He did a dolphin thing.
Dolphin thing.
He tried to kill me.
So last week, or this week actually, just a couple days ago, and I actually saw this on the air for some reason, Robert Flores was on ESPN and decided to say this.
Shade.
First, our monthly look at what did we learn? We learned that according to the Lakers' Nick Young, a dolphin recently tried to kill him. So, Nick, while dolphins are trying to kill you, your girlfriend's trying to kill hip-hop. Let's call it even, okay? First.
Shade.
Holy crap.
That is the most shade ever. And yeah. It's just like a local news guy?
No, this is ESPN. It was the top 10 of the month. What did we learn? Okay. So, through the shade, of course.
Swaggy P.
Swaggy P, that's his girl, can't just be coming at her all sideways. So he took to Twitter to let his thoughts be known. We got a problem. First tweet.
These fucking dolphins.
I'm going to read everyone. Since these sports channels want to act like BET, we shall see. It's cool to talk about me all day, any day. I'm fine with that. I could take a joke. That what I do joke, but I didn't see the point of that. I'm reading it exactly because this is how he wrote it. Got a lot of people trying to drain me of my energy. Mm-hmm. Robert Flores. He's a real smart ass. Goes, so what's been going on today? Oh, and then Swaggy P finished up with, we'll see each other real soon. So,
yeah. What's been going on today?
So, anything happening?
What's new, buddy?
Jokes.
What's up?
Nothing but jokes.
Well, you know, he's actually elevated his game. He used to be the sixth man on the bench. Mm-hmm. Is he starter for the Lakers now? I don't know.
Does anybody care?
I don't.
Exactly.
Chris, your nephew might.
Maybe.
Did you hear Oprah has a question? The question?
I heard about this.
So when she was filling her television network own, trying to find executives, she was interviewing people and she was whittling them down, and she would get her applicants to the point where she would ask them this one question. Uh-huh. What is your spiritual practice? Mm. And she says, first of all, the women who cried were immediately taken out of the running, Winfrey says. But for those who protested that they weren't religious, Winfrey clarified that she wasn't asking about religion. She was asking about their inner relationship with themselves. She was getting at, what do you do for yourself? What do you do to keep yourself centered, she says. She asked this because she considers her secret to success the fact that she's grounded in her own self and looks for others who are also as well. If we know who we are and what we want from life, Winfrey believes, then we can build meaningful relationships with each other and make our visions a reality. So that's her question. The question.
Wow.
I thought it'd be deeper. What's your spiritual practice?
Yeah.
If I was like interviewing.
It just sounds like some rich fucking bullshit question. So like make somebody dance in front of you. Dance, monkey dance.
Yeah. Go ahead. Let me ask you. What's your spiritual practice?
Are you asking me as you or as Oprah?
I'm asking as Oprah. What's your spiritual practice?
You're Oprah and you're asking me that.
Yeah. What's your spiritual practice?
Something to do with Deepak Chopra.
Okay, now I'm asking you, what's your spiritual practice? Something to do with Deepak Chopra.
Is that a good answer?
Come That's on, for an Oprah interview. It's
That's
a perfect answer.
A good answer for Oprah.
21 days of meditation. Bing, done. Mm-hmm.
What's my spiritual practice? I don't know, man. I got to think about that one. What's yours?
Orgasms.
See, I was going to go there, and then I was like, nah, my mom listens to this show. I don't want to be too, you know, risque. Speaking of risque. There are 7 scientific reasons why sleeping naked is really good for you.
You didn't have to tell me that. I'm a free baller for life.
We sleep naked.
I'm team commando.
Very true. We are naked sleepers. Apparently, only 8% of Americans sleep in the nude.
What?
Which is shocking to me.
Why would you want to be encumbered by
it's kind of crazy.
And no way.
Apparently, they all sleep. So you'll get way better sleep, according to the American Academy of Sleep.
Agreed.
Your body temperature naturally declines as part of your circadian rhythms as you sleep, and wearing pajamas can disrupt that. You can air out your lady parts, man.
I just said, free baller
for
life.
So, it's really good. It's healthy for your downstairs lady bits. Your vagina has a climate similar to a tropical rainforest. And it can be breeding ground.
That's not verbatim.
That is what it says. That is what it says.
And
it can be
a
breeding ground for bacteria and yeast. By ditching underwear and pajamas, you allow your vagina the much needed aeration it requires to stay dry and healthy. And as we all know, a healthy vagina is a happy one.
I'm all for rainforest like vagina spelunking.
You feel sexier. Sleeping naked is just plain old sexy. When you're with your new boyfriend, there's nothing nicer than walking in buff, ready and eager for morning sex. And waking up without pajamas is automatically puts you in a sexier state of mind. You'll reduce belly size.
I'm going to give a ding to morning sex.
Yeah. You'll reduce belly size. Apparently, if you opt for sleeping in a buff, you can reduce your fat around your belly and even lower your cholesterol. According to Huffington Post, your body cools down at night, increasing your growth hormones, which simultaneously decreases the level of cortisone, which results in healthy sleep patterns. And the perfect night's sleep would be composed of 2 cycles. The first, where your body's recuperating with lower cortisol levels. And the second sees your body working to increase these levels in preparation for the next day. If your sleep is interrupted by uncomfortable pajamas and stuff, your body will naturally produce more than usual and is known to catalyze your appetite. So it makes you hungrier when you sleep with them.
Very nice.
Get ready for lots more sex. If you sleep naked, you're going to have more sex. Dr. Landa says that sleeping naked encourages sex, and sexier relationships are happier relationships. You won't have to take a shower in the morning. It's, if there's one thing girls hate to do, it's shower. Well, I think that's a reference to Naya Rivera. And if there's one thing a human hates more, shower? It's showering first thing in the morning, as it forces you to wake up a full 20 to 30 minutes earlier. But if you don't wear pajamas, you'll stay cooler at night, drastically increasing the likeliness of a good hair day the following morning. And so people are pushing that. And it's just easier when it comes to hashtag team bed. Yeah. We're all just trying to get up in those comfy pillows and blankets as quickly as we possibly can. And putting on pajamas inherently means work.
And I'm just straight up going to tell you, like, right now, there might be no greater sensation on earth than crawling into a bed with the sheets that have just come out the dryer.
Yep.
They're crisp and they got the scented kind of dryer, whatever stuff we use to make stuff smell good in the dryer.
Yeah.
And you just crawl in and it's all like staticky and tingly all over your entire naked body. Come on. That especially if you like shower beforehand and you're all clean and ready to get into bed. That is like I'd say like the best night's sleep for me.
Yeah, it's
right with the new sheets. And
I just changed the sheets today.
I know.
So I'll get that experience tonight.
I don't know. And why would you fuck that up with underwear and shit? I don't get it.
There you have it, people. Sleep naked. Let's get that number up. 8%. Fuck that.
Yeah, International John's been team naked for decades.
20 years.
Team naked forever.
It's the truth, Ruth. We don't have kids though. I think that might change things. So, like, maybe somebody might walk in. Like, we live by ourselves, so.
Yeah, and I was thinking, it's funny, when we were going over the show notes and what we're going to have on the show, I said, oh, I'm trying to think when I started sleeping naked. And it was probably, it wasn't until I was, out of the home.
Of course,
right? Living with mom, I'm not even sleeping naked.
And I didn't sleep naked when I had a roommate, except for you, when we moved in together. Yeah, but definitely, yeah. And when we have people here, I tend to wear, like a nightshirt or something to bed.
Especially when the kids are
here. You never know. Yeah. They might need something or whatever. Sure. So I think maybe that's why the 8% is so low.
Because of kids?
Yeah, they just start barging into rooms and shit. You know how
if you've got kids, you really can't sleep naked.
That's what I'm saying.
Or I guess you could, but then you have to be prepared for scarring your children for life.
Yeah, nobody wants to do that.
And I knew people that, I remember growing up, there was people that like, my mom was naked here. I'm like, what? It's crazy.
Yeah.
Your parents are naked. They're in a hippie commune. Come on now.
So TV. We had some good TV this week.
Oh, man. Jinx. Life and Deaths.
Listen, if you people are not watching this, it's on HBO. It's called Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. It is crazy.
It's good.
It's really so good. It's about Robert Durst, who is a heir to the Durst real estate fortune, and went to trial for killing his neighbor, successfully got off, I might add, and was also suspected of in the disappearance of his wife, who has yet to be fined, Kathy Durst, and was memorialized in the movie All Good Things, starring Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst. And this series is a it's a reality show, basically.
Yeah. And if you don't remember, All Good Things was where the main character dressed in drag. And
yeah.
So, but.
They can look that up. But yeah. I'm just setting the scene. So, so the each episode, it's a documentary series more than a reality show. But the maker of the movie, the director of the movie, Robert, saw the movie and contacted him and said, hey, I haven't been able to really talk to anybody. And after seeing your movie, I think you're the right person to talk
to. Story.
And so they are juxtaposing the actual information of what has happened with the director interviewing Bobby Durst. And it has been disturbing, say the least.
I mean, there's when you see it all laid out so clearly, right? Because it's a documentary and they're editing it. It's basically he paid $1.8 million to get off. To get away with murder.
Yep.
And the way he got away with murder is because they found the body that he chopped into pieces and dragged out.
Right.
And he was like, well, of course I chopped him up. He was bigger and I couldn't carry him out. It was no big deal that he chopped this guy into pieces.
Right.
And the parts of the body were in like trash bags. And he went back to this place where he dumped it and saw that they weren't sinking and found the head and purportedly or ostensibly did something with the head, and now you don't know where the head is. The head's missing.
Right.
And his defense was that they struggled and he was fighting and the guy was blackmailing him and the gun went off and he got shot in the face and it was self-defense. And that's Texas. Galveston, Texas. Like, stand your ground kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury, I think at one point he said there was no more than three people that were ever voting guilty in the jury pool.
He actually took the stand.
Yeah.
The prosecution was like, was shocked. And he had one line he gave and the jury laughed. And the cops, the detectives were like, did the jury just laugh at what he said?
Yeah, we're done.
Like, we're fucking done.
We're done.
We're done. And the way that the law works in Texas, and I'm sure in lots of other states, A, once someone enters your home, there's a lot you can do to them if you feel threatened. That's number one. Number two, without the head, which is where he said that the shot went, they don't even have a cause of death.
Yeah.
All they have is dismembered body parts. So the only witness to whatever happened is Robert, and with no evidence to contradict what he says, they have nothing.
It's worse than that. So they show the trial, and then they show Robert Durst talking about this lawyer he paid, you know, $1.8 million, you know, like to two different lawyers. And the lawyer is saying, now listen, you know, this was a traumatic experience. If you don't remember something, and it would be really normal for you to forget something like this, you know, if it doesn't help you, you don't have to say it. I'm not saying you have to lie. I'm just saying you don't have
to
remember.
In fact, he says, like, I'm not telling you to lie.
I'm not telling you to lie, but you don't have to remember. And I'm telling you, don't try to remember.
Right. And he's saying you don't have to share anything that you don't feel would help
correct.
You.
Correct.
Just answer their questions. Well, so that's what a lawyer does. There he was coaching him.
Absolutely. But so it's a more modern equivalent of the Fifth, right? I plead the Fifth. I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it may incriminate me, is I don't remember.
Right.
I don't remember. So he conveniently doesn't remember anything.
A bunch of stuff.
A bunch of things. And so then he's talking to the director. And if you guys are watching this, like, he's got these beady little eyes.
Oh
my God,
he's creepy.
It's almost, his voice is kind of creepy.
He blinks constantly.
Oh,
his eyes are like jet black.
The way he talks about things in such a
matter of fact,
yeah. You know, almost like psychopathic, just
yeah.
You know, really detached.
For
and like,
sure.
Oh, of course, I had to chop his body up. How else was I going to get him outside?
But that's the only thing that made sense.
Of course, I cut his arms off.
Oh, right, Bob, you're right. Well, that's what I would do.
So they're asking about him using the phrase "I don't remember" and kind of pleading the Fifth, and the lawyer and the coaching, and they're talking about it. And the director gets up and
he says, can we take a break?
Right,
he needed something to drink.
So he's still mic'd and sitting in the chair, Robert Durst is. But and the cameras are rolling, but the director moves away and Durst ostensibly thinks that he's alone. And it gave me fucking chills. He starts whispering under his breath, coaching himself, I did not knowingly, willingly lie.
I did not knowingly, willingly lie. I did not knowingly, willingly lie.
Over like five times, six times. And finally his lawyer comes over and is like, Bob, your mic is on. He's like, I see. So what I see. It was hurt. Okay. I see. It was just so, it literally gave me chills. It was like creepy as fuck. And this is only like the third episode or fourth episode, right?
Yes.
It's good shit.
It is.
It's HBO, but they now have a $15 a month subscription.
That's
HBO
it.
Go.
And then the other thing we wanted to talk about real quick was 12 Monkeys. I think we've talked about it before. It's on Sci-Fi. It comes on Friday nights. It's just really awesome. I have no idea what the F is going to happen tomorrow because I don't want to say what happened in case people are watching it, but something happened that I'm like, what the F? And it's really good, but you wanted to just shout out the one line.
They do time travel, and obviously it's 12 Monkeys, and they do the whole, like, you know, paradox, you can't really interact with yourself kind of thing of that, but they allow, in their version of time travel, people to go back and be in the same place and time as their younger self. So there could be like two versions of like me running around, one from this time and one from like 30 years in the future, right? And so he's talking to this one dude. He's trying to enlist his like support, and he's like telling him about all this stuff, and he's doing this, and he's there. And he's basically telling him, because it's future me coming back and telling you about present me what I'm doing. But it's like he's off here with this girl doing this other thing, and he looks at him and goes, "You're sitting right here, you crazy piece of shit." And it just was like the best line. He's like,
"It was great.
You're sitting right here.
You're sitting right here, you crazy piece of shit." So funny. So funny, so funny.
Good stuff.
Yeah, really good. So those are two good shows. And podcasting, we're going to give a shout out to our podcasting brother and sister from
Another
the Great
Mother.
North, Chonilla, Clove, and Shirley. Love those guys.
Did you see the Throwback Thursday they posted?
I saw their Throwback Thursday
in like
pictures.
A fucking limo, dude.
They're high school sweethearts. They're so freaking cute.
It's adorable.
Oh my gosh. Clove looks hilarious. Chollet looks very
glamorous. Clove had gangster lean. He had swagger in the 80s, man.
According to him, no. But I was like, yeah, but you pulled Chollet. So that kind of tells me you did. Just saying.
And I think, in fact, I got to pull it up. Did she have shoulder pads on?
No, she had like a sparkly dress that had like a wrap, like a, what are they called? A halter top, kind of, where it goes around your neck, you know?
All right, I'll find it. But it was an awesome picture.
It was an awesome picture. So shout out to them. You can find them on chonella.com. Thanks for joining us once again for the Interracial John Podcast. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mack, M-A-C, and my cohort at Very White Guy. And again, you can find the show on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search for Interracial John, J-A-W-N, or our website, interracialjohn.com. And I think that's it.
That's it.
That's it.
Oh, wait. I got to play my good night, everybody. Hold on.
Good night, everybody.
High five.